The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Lots to get to on today's program. Another beautiful day, by the way, here at Edstone. We're into the month of May. We're coming down to the last week of our college classes and, of course, all the summer activities yet ahead of us. On today's show, as I mentioned yesterday, I'm going to be talking some later on in this segment or maybe the next. We'll see how it goes. But we're going to be talking about my visit along with my family to Monticello just a couple of weeks ago, the beautiful estate of Thomas Jefferson there in the heart of Virginia. We'll talk more about some from that visit and also just some of the history surrounding Thomas Jefferson. Well, today, the Attorney General, William Barr, he's scheduled to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee about the Trump-Russia investigation, and there will surely be some fireworks in that testimony because of the big reveal. This is the big story, the Washington Post tells us, and the New York Times. They got the leaks together like they've done for the last 2-3 years. Apparently, Robert Mueller, he wrote a letter back in March complaining to the Attorney General, Mr. Barr, after he released that 4-page memo, or I guess Mueller calls it a summary, and Barr has said, I didn't mean for it to be a summary. I just wanted to get the conclusions out there because the public wanted to know. Well, we now know that evidently Mr. Barr sent, or rather Mr. Mueller, sent a letter to Mr. Barr that has now been leaked to the Washington Post and the New York Times. And Mueller told him that he didn't fully capture the context or nature or the substance of Mueller's work with that 4-page memo. So more leaks. And really, if you think about the fact that the entirety of the report, there's the redactions, of course, that we haven't yet seen, but you have the 4-page memo, and then you have the entire 400 and whatever pages from the report itself. It's all out there. And really, the problem here for the media, what they're upset about, is that Mr. Barr was the one who established the narrative. And, of course, his narrative was based upon the facts revealed in that report. There was no collusion. And for 2 years, as you know, for 2 years, the media were expecting proof. Black and white proof, evidence of collusion. So that's really what's underlying this big revelation from yesterday. You have the media now who are desperately trying to make this story about William Barr because they didn't get what they wanted from the report. So, well, Mr. Barr must be biased. Mr. Barr is now just speaking for Donald Trump. CNN says, William Barr is in deep trouble. He's in deep trouble because of this revelation. He came out and released the 4-page memo before we even saw the report. He shouldn't have done that. And then, of course, when he released the full report, he also he came out with that statement. And I can't remember if he took questions during that statement before the press or not, but they don't like that either at CNN. And really, what they don't like, as I say, is the fact that they didn't get what they wanted from the report itself. All the Attorney General has done is revealed what the essence of the report was, and then he gave the report a few weeks later for everyone to see. But yesterday, out comes these reports from the New York Times and the Washington Post. And as Newt Gingrich was saying on Fox last night, it's really just intended to embarrass the Attorney General ahead of these hearings before the Senate the next couple of days. This is what Gingrich said last night, clip 9.
I assume somebody wanted to leak it to maximize the embarrassment to Barr and to set up the questions for the hearings the next 2 days. You know, look, the deep state in Washington has played these games for the whole history of the country. This is not something new.
It's not new, but it's especially bad during this administration, as we've seen for the last few years. This is from the Washington Post revelation. It says here, at the time Mueller's letter was sent to Barr on March 27, Barr had days prior announced that Mueller did not find a conspiracy between the Trump campaign and Russian officials seeking to interfere in the 2016 election. In his memo to Congress, Barr also said that Mueller had not reached a conclusion about whether Trump had tried to obstruct justice, but that Barr reviewed the evidence and found it insufficient to support such a charge. So all of that's true, and this is his job. He gets the report. He relays to the American people there's no collusion. He says to the American people, the report or Mueller did not reach a conclusion with respect to obstruction, but I have. I'm the Attorney General. There was no obstruction of justice. There was no underlying crime. The Washington Post went on to say, days after Barr's announcement, Mueller wrote the previously undisclosed private letter. It's a private letter, but now it's been leaked. It's been leaked by someone either on Barr's side or on Mueller's side. It says it's been leaked. Now it's disclosed. The letter laying out his concerns in stark terms that shocked senior Justice Department officials. The summary letter the department sent to Congress and released to the public late in the afternoon of March 24th did not fully capture the context, nature, and substance of this office's work and conclusions. That's quoting from Mueller's letter to the Attorney General. Mr. Mueller said, there is now public confusion about critical aspects of the results of our investigation. This threatens to undermine a central purpose for which the department appointed the special counsel, to assure full public confidence in the outcome of the investigations. So here again, why would he complain about the four-page letter when the entirety of the report is now out there? If you remember what they were saying as soon as the four-page letter was released that Sunday evening, the Democrats' initial response was that, well, we can't put too much stock into this letter. We've got to see the report. So then a few weeks later, they see the report. And then they're shocked, or they should have been. No evidence of collusion. They have nothing to hang their hat on. So now they're going after William Barr. But listen to this. You've got to go a few paragraphs into the Washington Post piece yesterday to get to the real facts of the matter. It says a day after Mueller sent his letter to Barr, the two men spoke by phone for about 15 minutes, according to law enforcement officials. This is astounding to me that these kinds of leaks, they just happen routinely now. I guess we're just supposed to be used to it. So we know about the letter. The Washington Post and the New York Times, they've read the letter yesterday. And they also know about the 15-minute phone conversation that Mueller had with Barr. It says, in that call, Mueller said he was concerned that media coverage of the obstruction investigation was misguided and creating public misunderstandings about the office's work, according to Justice Department officials. Mueller did not express similar concerns about the public discussion of the investigation of Russia's election interference, the officials said. Barr has testified previously he did not know whether Mueller supported his conclusion on obstruction. And then this paragraph, I think this is paragraph 13. It says, when Barr pressed Mueller on whether he thought Barr's memo to Congress was inaccurate, Mueller said that he did not, but felt that the media coverage of it was misinterpreting the investigation. So he was pressed. Barr pressed him. Well, was there anything that I said in the four-page letter or the four-page memo that was inaccurate? No, that was right. That was the truth. Well, then what are you upset about? He was upset about the media coverage, as if the Attorney General can fix that. He should be upset about the media coverage the last 3 years. Complaining about the media coverage? Special counsel Robert Mueller III? He's complaining about the media coverage? The facts are out there. The report is done. 4 investigations. The FBI, the special counsel, the Senate, the House, all 4. There's no collusion. And yet there's still plenty of people that want to see this thing continue with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 more investigations if they can keep it going. Mueller investigated this. His report is now public. There's no collusion. He didn't draw a conclusion regarding obstruction, but the Attorney General did. There's no story here, except that if you really want to get excited about something, if you really want to give some really solid reporting, go to paragraph 13 in the Washington Post article and build the report, build the news story, build the coverage around that. Was there anything in that 4-page memo that was not the truth? Well, no, it was the truth. Really, what he was saying is that he was concerned about the spin. The Attorney General got out there first with the facts, and they weren't able to spin it. The president's critics, they weren't able to spin it like they usually do. From Zero Hedge, it says here about that letter, the one Mueller wrote to Barr, it says, another deep state leak has hit the tape, and as usual, it has gone to the Washington Post and New York Times almost at the exact same time. It then goes on to explain how laughable this is. Because you get down to paragraph 13 and find out that Mueller agrees with Barr. Isn't that astounding? But like Zero Hedge brings out, all of the president's critics, all of his haters, they're just going to go to the headline and maybe the first 2 or 3 paragraphs, and that's it. And that's it. They've got enough to run with. CNN, CNN's headline, William Barr is in deep trouble. Oh, he's in trouble. He is? What did he do? He got the contents of the report out there as fast as possible. And now he's going before the Senate hearing today. And soon he'll go before the House, I'm sure. The investigations will continue because of these kinds of reports. It really does. And you'll see, I think, the connection here with this next section, because you have to get down to paragraph 13, so to speak, if you're going to find the truth. We do have to be diligent. We have to be diggers if we're going to get to the truth of the matter. And then, like the Bible says, we've got to hold on to it. Prove it. Prove all things. And hold fast to that which is good. That's 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 21. Last week, the former vice president, Joe Biden, he released his initial video there, 3-4 minutes worth, where he announced his candidacy for president. Since that time, he's had a couple of rallies. He's been on the news. I think he released another campaign commercial yesterday. But the first one, he built the first one around Charlottesville from August 2017. He's out there fanning the flames of racial division and strife. He introduced his candidacy on that event, that violence. There was one person who was killed in that violence from 2.5 years ago. And so that's what he's putting out there. That's how he's introducing his run for president. Here's what he had to say in that campaign commercial, clip 1.
Charlottesville, Virginia. is home to the author of one of the great documents in human history. We know it by heart. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We've heard it so often, it's almost a cliche, but it's who we are. We haven't always lived up to these ideals. Jefferson himself didn't.
That's Joe Biden telling us that Thomas Jefferson did not live up to those ideals. Of course, he does. Joe Biden does. He's going to make America moral again, he said last night in an interview. He knows the definition of morality. He knows what's right and wrong. Thomas Jefferson certainly did not. He didn't live up to those ideals. There's quite a few critics of Thomas Jefferson coming out of the woodwork, coming from academia. They're now, a lot of them are commentators on CNN, NBC. All of them live up to the ideals of the Declaration, but not Thomas Jefferson. And it's pretty clear. It's pretty clear now that the caretakers of the Monticello estate, they think the same way. It's shocking. It's shocking what they say. This man that used to be idolized. American children were brought up to idolize Thomas Jefferson. He's one of the founders. He's the author of the Declaration. But the negative tone that they take today at the university, on TV, even at Monticello, it's shocking. Let me just take you back again to this this Joe Biden announcement. This is clip two.
It was there on August of 2017 we saw Klansmen and white supremacists and neo-Nazis come out in the open. Their crazed faces, illuminated by torches, veins bulging and bearing the fangs of racism, chanting the same anti-Semitic bile heard across Europe in the 30s. And they were met by a courageous group of Americans, and a violent clash ensued.
Well, the KKK and the white supremacists, they were there, but they weren't exactly met by a courageous group of Americans. They were met by the hood-wearing, club-wielding, far-left, violent agitators known as Antifa. That's the truth. But that gets left out. That's been erased from the record. That's been scrubbed from the record. That's been removed from all the footage blocks. Here he is now, taking his aim, Joe Biden, at the president, Donald Trump, and his response or his reaction to what happened there at Charlottesville. This is clip three.
And that's when we heard the words of the President of the United States that stunned the world and shocked the conscience of this nation. He said there were, quote, some very fine people on both sides. Very fine people on both sides?
Now, to get to the truth of what actually happened and what was said, you have to go back to that contentious press conference. We talked about it at the time. Or look at the transcript. Look at what the president said, and then consider what the reporters were saying and the president's response each time. His remarks following Charlottesville have been repeatedly, they've been repeatedly misrepresented to suggest that he was endorsing some people on the far, far right, some people within those groups, KKK, white supremacists, white nationalists. When in fact, and you can see it for yourself, if you go back and read the transcript, he was saying there were also peaceful protesters there, some of them supporting the removal of statues like Robert E. Lee, and some of them opposing that. He was not saying that there were some among the white supremacist groups who were fine people. And you can listen to it for yourself. Here's a clip from that August 2017 press conference, President Trump, clip four.
Excuse me, I saw the same pictures as you did. You had people in that group that were there to protest the taking down of, to them, a very, very important statue and the renaming of a park from Robert E. Lee to another name.
Well,
no, George Washington was a slave owner. Was George Washington a slave owner? So will George Washington now lose his status? Are we going to take down, excuse me, are we going to take down statues to George Washington? How about Thomas Jefferson? What do you think of Thomas Jefferson? You like him? Okay, good. Are we going to take down the statue? Because he was a major slave owner. Now, are we going to take down his statue? So you know what? It's fine. You're changing history. You're changing culture. And you had people, and I'm not talking about the neo-Nazis and the white nationalists, because they should be condemned totally. But you had many people in that group other than neo-Nazis and white nationalists, okay? And the press has treated them absolutely unfairly.
Note the last part there of that exchange. I am not talking about the neo-Nazis and the white nationalists because they should be condemned totally. I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about the people who say that we shouldn't erase our history. I'm talking about the tens of thousands of people. How many? Millions, perhaps. Millions who don't want to see statues of Robert E. Lee torn down. And then, like he brings out, where do you stop? He went on to say that in this same press conference. Robert E. Lee, he said, I noticed Stonewall Jackson, he's coming down. What about George Washington then? Is it going to be him next week? Is it going to be Thomas Jefferson the week after that? The president said, you really have to ask yourself, where does it stop? Where do you stop this? So as I say, you heard it, just 60 seconds worth. But where is there an honest journalist or opponent of President Trump's who will go back and actually look at what he said and consider? Do we really want to erase our history? Because this individual, based upon the way we see it today, well, he was obviously immoral. Joe Biden, when he heard the president, who came out this week following that commercial by Joe Biden to say that, well, what you just heard there, I wasn't talking about the KKK. This was Biden's response to the president's response just yesterday or the day before, clip five.
I tell you what, I don't think we've ever heard, very fine was his phrase, very fine people on both sides. You know, and just a few days ago when the president was critical of my saying that, and I said it back and wrote an article in Atlantic Magazine at the time it occurred, he now has come down and doubled down on concocting a phony story about how these violent thugs only wanted to protect the statue of Robert E. Lee. Give me a break. No, I mean, this is enough's enough, man. This is nonsense.
And if you notice, he changed it further, saying that the president came out over the past week to double down on concocting a phony story about how these violent thugs only wanted to protect the statue of Robert E. Lee. The president said, I'm not talking about the neo-Nazis or the white nationalists. They should be condemned. I'm talking about the good people, and there are good people on both sides. Some want to pull down the statues, others don't. But my position is, if you pull that one down, where does it stop? Well, those that asked that same question, they withstood quite a firestorm of rebuke on Twitter, social media, and such in the days that followed. The violence at Charlottesville. Well, come on. There's a difference. There's a difference between Robert E. Lee and George Washington. Is there? This was said on CNN by Angela Rye just a few days after Charlottesville. This was said. She's the executive, or I think she's the former executive director of the Congressional Black Caucus. This is someone pretty high up, and she's on national television. And this was days, just a few days after Charlottesville, clip six.
George Washington was a slave owner, and we need to call slave owners out for what they are. Whether we think they were protecting American freedom or not, he wasn't protecting my freedom. I wasn't someone who my ancestors weren't deemed human beings to him. And so to me, I don't care if it's a George Washington statue or a Thomas Jefferson statue or a Robert E. Lee statue. They all need to come down.
They all need to come down. We need to abolish the past. First, it's the statues, and it's not just Robert E. Lee. It's all the others as well. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson. And of course, you know where this is headed. After the statues, after erasing the history, then you go after the documents. The Declaration of Independence. The Constitution of the United States. That was written mostly by Madison, slave owner. Jefferson was a slave owner. As I said, when my family went through Monticello just a couple of weeks ago, what a shock it was. I guess I could have known about this ahead of time by just doing a little bit of research. I'll get to an article that was in the New York Times about a year ago about Monticello. But I hadn't read up on it and was shocked to witness the negative tone. As I said, it wasn't that long ago when young Americans were brought up to idolize Thomas Jefferson. He was a hero. Not perfect. We do have sins in our past. It's certainly worth telling the truth about those sins. You've got the history, the warts and all, as they say. But to destroy the record, or to revise the record, as those tour guides have done, those tour guides who work at Monticello today. Over this past year, we've been really focusing in on the importance of reading and studying and history. And if you remember, I think it was at the end of last summer, we played quite a few clips from David McCullough. We were just coming into the start of the school year. Some of us were reading McCullough's biography about John Adams. A wonderful book, but almost just as fascinating as the book was just reading a little bit or hearing a little bit from the author of the book, who's been around for quite a while. I think Mr. McCullough's 85 years old. A wonderful writer, historian, researcher. And he said back in 2005, this is maybe 15 years ago now, he talked about what it was that really lit a fire in him as far as loving history is concerned. He talked about how he became passionate about history. I think this was actually testimony before the Senate or the House, one of the chambers in Congress. Here's clip seven from 2005.
We have to take them to those historic sites ourselves. Don't wait for the school trip. Senator Kennedy has been taking his nieces and nephews and many of his family to historic places year after year. It's a wonderful family tradition. It ought to be a family tradition everywhere because those trips can change your life. I was taken to Monticello by a school pal and his mother and father on spring vacation when I was about 14. And I know it changed my life. It's what started me down the trail in my interest in history.
That's from the historian David McCullough. And if you backtrack from the age that he's at today, he would have visited Monticello for the first time at the age of 14, sometime in the late 1940s. And it changed his life. It changed his life. It started him down the trail to have a love for history. And I wonder how many 14-year-olds today, after visiting Monticello, after following these tour guides who are there taking such a negative tone about one of the nation's founders, you wonder if they'd take an interest in history like Mr. McCullough did back in the late 1940s. There's something very evil and sinister at work here. We've talked before about the significance of 1986 and Satan being cast down. Revelation 12, verses 7 through 9. How that Satan deceives the whole world. Jesus said that Satan is the father of lies. He tells lies, and Revelation 12 says he's now confined to this earth. This is why it's so hard to get to the truth. Even if it's written in a daily paper, you've got to go down to paragraph 13. My father said in the hidden cause of society's deadly decline, this was the article in 2013 that became a chapter in America Under Attack. He talked about, just to paraphrase, he talked about just how dangerous it is when we get into a wrong attitude, how that Satan preys on people's emotions and moods. And if there's negative emotions there or bad attitudes, that really opens the way for Satan to exert a powerful influence on our thinking. Ephesians 2:2 says he's the prince of the power of the air. And he's come down to this earth. He's come down to you, it says in Revelation 12:12. And he's filled with wrath. And he knows he has but a short time. What a turning point it was in 1986. Of course, that booklet, America Under Attack, we talk a lot about the Bork nomination in 1987. Robert Bork, the former Marine, the law graduate from the University of Chicago, professor at Yale Law School, the former U.S. Solicitor General. He served as the acting Attorney General and as a Court of Appeals judge. That's the one that they went after in 1987, because the way they viewed it, Joe Biden was among them, by the way, Teddy Kennedy led the way. He led the charge. They viewed Robert Bork as immoral. And so within minutes of his announcement, well, Reagan's announcement that he was going to nominate Bork, they assassinated his character. They went after him viciously. And then they did the same thing in the early 1990s with Clarence Thomas. And then they did the same thing last year with Brett Kavanaugh. We've seen this over and again. My father said in that 2013 piece about something changing in 1986, the devil being cast down, it says, and he began his lawless rampage, casting truth to the ground. I saw it with my own eyes. The damage he wreaked on God's church. Now it's becoming ever clearer that he's unleashing the same kind of destruction on our nations. And he's using the same tactics to do it. When he attacked the church, he got people in the top. He got people at the very top and then cast the truth to the ground. It's an assault on law, he went on to say. It's an assault on history. My father, again, he talks about those parallels. You see the destruction, the abomination of desolation in God's church. And then you see the same tactics at play in our nations as well. And it's not just with politicians that go against the radical left or judges. It's even our own founders. They must come under attack as well. Thomas Jefferson authored the Declaration of Independence, America's founding document. That document contains ideals that continue to this day, that all races in the United States should be very much thankful for. It defines the purpose of the American Republic. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And with those words, the founders of the United States unleashed a wave of freedom that went right around the world in so many ways. It stretched right across America. It did not come to blacks until, what was it, 90 or 100 years later. And there are scars. And there was immeasurable suffering for the black people in the United States. And those sins caught up with the United States in the 1860s. No doubt about it. That's history. That's part of our record. But because of those sins, some people want to just scrub the history entirely. Take them all down. Thomas Jefferson said that he got his best ideas for democracy out of America's churches. All men are created equal. That comes from the Bible. Calvin Coolidge, in talking about the Declaration in 1926, that was the 150th anniversary, he talked about the importance of the Bible in influencing those founding documents. Everyone's equal. Everyone should be subject to the same law. Coolidge said in 1926, no other theory is adequate to explain or comprehend the Declaration of Independence. It is the product of the spiritual insight of the people. We live in an age of science and of abounding accumulation of material things. These did not create our Declaration. Our Declaration created them. Our Declaration is the reason we have so much abundance and prosperity and freedom. Coolidge said the things of the Spirit come first. Unless we cling to that, all our material prosperity, overwhelming though it may appear, will turn to a barren scepter in our grasp. If we're to maintain the great heritage which has been bequeathed to us, we must be like-minded as the fathers who created it. We must not sink into pagan materialism. We must cultivate the reverence which they had for the things that are holy. We've got to hold on to those founding documents. We've got to know our history. We've got to learn the lessons from the mistakes of our own history. Don't erase it. Don't tear it down. Don't revise it. We followed a couple of tour guides in our Monticello visit. And the first one, when taking us through the house, Jefferson's house, she asked, well, was Jefferson a good man who did a few bad things, or was he a bad man who did a few good things? And then all through that tour, we were urged, now you make sure you go outside and you take this tour for the slavery and the exhibit here and understand all these other things as well. And then that led to the big shock outside the home, where another tour guide told us that Thomas Jefferson raped Sally Hemings, and he started in with that when she was 14 years old, when she came over to Paris with Thomas Jefferson's little girl, who was 8 at the time. Thus began this sexual relationship that went on for 37 years. And well, how can you say it was a sexual relationship or even an adulterous relationship when she's a slave? This was rape. Thomas Jefferson, the rapist. We learned that he practically starved his slaves. We learned about the ideals that are inscribed on his tombstone. Jefferson's epitaph. He was most proud of the Declaration of Independence, it says on that tombstone. But how can we be proud of that? All men certainly weren't equal in Jefferson's day. That's what we heard on this visit. Jefferson was also proud of the Statute of Virginia for Religious Freedom. And of course, that was a document that was very influential with respect to the Constitution as well, the Bill of Rights specifically. But how can you, so this tour guide said, how can you say that there's religious freedom in the United States, even today? He asked. And then there's the statement on the tombstone about Jefferson being the father of the University of Virginia. He was proud of that, but not this tour guide. Because for the longest time, the University of Virginia was a gentleman's university. It took a while before they admitted women. All of this discrimination, all of these immoral acts. How can you even look at his tombstone and have a sense of pride? This is what we learned in our visit to Monticello 2 weeks ago. The New York Times from last summer, as I say. You could have, learned about this ahead of time. This is from the New York Times in June a year ago. Monticello is done avoiding Jefferson's relationship with Sally Hemings. It says the newly opened space at Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's palatial mountaintop plantation, is presented as the living quarters of Sally Hemings, an enslaved woman who bore the founding father's children. That's not even controversial anymore. That's just been accepted as fact. And did you know that's been accepted as fact just in the past 15, 20 years? That's right. That's right. We know so much more about Jefferson's sins just in the last couple of decades than they knew in the early 1800s, the late 1800s, the mid-1900s. This, by the way, was a scurrilous rumor started by one of Jefferson's political enemies in 1802. His name was James Callender. James Callender, he didn't get something from Jefferson that he wanted. He didn't get appointed to this or that. Does this sound familiar? You see it today. It's human nature. He didn't get what he wanted, and so he comes out with this scandalous gossip saying that Thomas Jefferson was sleeping with one of his slaves. Now, there were certainly atrocities that went on in the South. Horrible atrocities. Horrible mistreatment. A lot of scandalous behavior, to be sure. And so here comes one of his political opponents saying, well, because this sort of thing has happened before, Jefferson must be guilty too. The New York Times is on board with that. And so are the tour guides at Monticello. It says in the New York Times from last year, it's a culmination of a 25-year effort to grapple with the reality of slavery in the home of one of liberty's most eloquent champions. They've been working on this for 25 years, this transformation. And it says later on, the public opening deals a final blow to 2 centuries of ignoring, playing down, or covering up what amounted to an open secret. No facts presented here. It just says here that the gossip, it was an open secret. Everyone knew about it, but it was hush hush. His relationship with a slave that spanned nearly 4 decades from his time abroad in Paris to his death, all the way through to 1826. Did you know this? It doesn't It doesn't get any better. It gets a lot worse. Keep reading in the New York Times. And you see where they're headed. You see where they're taking this. You know what's following. The movement to pull down Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson. The New York Times says, to make the exhibit possible, curators had to wrestle with a host of thorny questions. The thorniest of all in an era of Black Lives Matter and Me Too, how to describe the decades-long sexual relationship between Jefferson and Sally Hemings. Should it be described as rape? Well, they've concluded that, yes, it should be. Now, this article says that it should be described as rape, but with a question mark. We didn't hear a question mark 2 weeks ago. So this article is from 2018, and now it's even worse. It just keeps getting worse. Who's behind this? And how far will it go? It talks about all the changes they've made to the estate. The focus is almost solely now on slavery. The New York Times said last June, it's phasing out the popular house tour. Think of it. Jefferson's house. It's phasing out the popular house tour of the mansion, which made only minimal mention of slavery alongside Jefferson's accomplishments, radically changing what is experienced by the more than 400,000 tourists who visit Monticello annually. 400,000 people. As we were leaving on our visit, busloads of children coming along. Maybe they were 14 years of age, just like David McCullough from the late 1940s. It changed his life. It opened his eyes to American history. He loved it. I don't think the 14-year-olds of today are going to go away from a Monticello visit, eager to learn more about America's founders or its founding documents. What I want you to think about is just how much has changed, and dramatically so, just in the last few years. How much has changed even since this New York Times piece came out a year ago. This was Barack Obama at Monticello. He was with the French president at the time. This is just 2014. This is 5 years ago. Listen to what Barack Obama said in 2014, clip 8.
As one of our founding fathers, the person who drafted our Declaration of Independence, somebody who not only was an extraordinary political leader, but also one of our great scientific and cultural leaders, Thomas Jefferson represents what's best in America.
Thomas Jefferson represents what's best in America, said Barack Obama 5 years ago. And you wonder if he'd be able to say the same thing today. Just given the spirit of this age, the power of the devil's influence, and how far to the left this movement is going. Now, in those statements, it was pretty balanced, actually, listening to Barack Obama. He went on to say that this estate, it also represents a complicated history that the United States has. As I say, the sins of the past, they're there. But they want to take Jefferson-owned slaves to Jefferson tortured people. Jefferson was a monster. Jefferson was a rapist. Jefferson was a pedophile. It says the exhibit has stoked outrage among a small but determined group of Jefferson enthusiasts who insist that he didn't father Hemings' children. Now, this you see at the very end of the New York Times article. You have to read past paragraph 10, paragraph 15. You've got to go all, it's a long article, and you've got to go all the way to the end to see that there are scholars and historians that think the entire premise of this relationship with Hemings is fake. It's fake news. It's fake history. That's what it is. That's the truth. And who's behind it? The devil. He's the father of lies. He loves lies. There's a book I've been reading over the past 4 or 5 days. It's by some guy, William Hyland Jr., written in 2009 in defense of Thomas Jefferson. And he says early on in the preface, Jefferson was the president who abolished the slave trade with Africa. The indefatigable Virginian taught himself to read and write Spanish while on his 19-day voyage across the ocean. Though born a wealthy man, he died a debtor, having spent the majority of his fortune on launching our nation, a stark contrast to today's politicians. And then in 1814, after British warships burned the White House and the Library of Congress, Jefferson sold the majority of his personal books to the Library of Congress to jumpstart its recovery. Those are just a few bulleted items. He's responsible for the Louisiana Purchase in 1803. He wrote the Declaration of Independence. America, as we know it today, whether white, black, brown, whatever, it is what it is, largely because of men like Thomas Jefferson. That's the truth. This book, by the way, it talks about this 1998 DNA farce. This guy who tried to get the story, someone in the United States to run with the story. He wanted to test the DNA of one of Thomas Jefferson's uncles. He couldn't even get the DNA of Jefferson himself. He didn't have any male heirs, Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson. So he went and got the uncle, then he tried to connect to some of the descendants of Sally Hemings. And in 3 tests, he found 1 match, a child of Sally Hemings that was related to A. Jefferson. And of course, the headline, he had to come to the UK to get someone to run with it, because nobody would in the United States, not in 1998. Oh, they do today. Even so much so that the tour guides at Monticello, of all places, they run with that headline. So the headline comes out in 1998, Thomas Jefferson fathered the slave child. And even the one who led this DNA study was shocked by the headline. Even he felt like it went too far. Well, let me read to you what it says in this book, In Defense of Thomas Jefferson. It says on page 4, following the DNA study, there was a little noticed subsequent study, a 13-member blue ribbon panel of prominent historians and scientists, white, black, male, female, named to reconfirm the DNA conclusions. After a year of investigating history's most famous paternity case, the independent historians tamped down the simmering allegation. Our conclusions, this is quoting from their report, our conclusions range from serious skepticism about the charge to a conviction that it is almost certainly false. But you see, that didn't get near as many headlines because the damage had already been done. And now it's just received by everyone. Now everyone agrees, right? Not nearly as many headlines. This fellow in his book on page 21, he contacted, after he looked into some of the DNA results from 1998, he contacted the FBI, their DNA lab, to ask about this guy's conclusion. And this is what the FBI said in response. I don't deal, this was a representative, or a historian that had contacted the FBI. I didn't deal or don't deal in inferences. As a former journalist, I got on the phone and called the head of the DNA lab at the FBI, Jennifer Smith, who told me this case wouldn't hold up in court because the DNA has to be direct from the father. That is an impossibility because his only son died, Jefferson's. And as long as there are other possibilities of people who had access to Sally Hemings, the case would be thrown out of court on those grounds. It wouldn't even be admitted into court today if he were given a fair trial. But that's not what they want. They don't want fairness. They don't want this to be just. We saw how they play this out last year with Brett Kavanaugh. Look, if you can throw gang rape in there, do it. Just destroy the man. And they have. They have. Postmortem. He's been assassinated. His character's been assassinated. And everyone's on board. Scholars, academics, even the tour guides. Even the tour guides at Monticello. What a shame. A national treasure. A national treasure that inspired an aspiring historian at the age of 14. It inspired him. And it should inspire you. This is America's history. Warts and all, this is America's founding. And this is what our adversary, the devil, is working so hard to destroy. He hates it. He's hostile to history and works so hard to destroy it, as my father said in the Ezekiel booklet. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send any and all comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.